My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest joined the British Army aged 17. He became a Royal Engineer, commando, diver, and was one of the first soldiers to become a member of the Special Boat Service. We talk evacuations in Libya, mental health, cycling well records, and raising nearly £1 million for charity. Episode 29, Dean Stott. This is Declassified. Where was you born?
So I was born in Swindon. I'm a PADS brat, or a military child. So my father was based in Tidworth, and he was away at the time. So my mother got airlifted to RAF Rorton, which is just outside Swindon. So yeah, from a military family, born into a military base.
Yeah, and so, what your childhood was spent?
And yeah, because my father was in the military, you know, we were pretty much like nomads in the military. Every 3 years, you'd upheave and you'd move home. So we travel around with my father. We're from Manchester, Bradford, Germany, and we actually then finished up in Aldershot. So my dad was the Sergeant Major at 3RSME in the Royal Engineers. It's a training establishment in Camberley.
Oh, right, okay.
So, yeah.
So engineer as well?
Yeah.
So you joined February 2005, 1995.
Yeah, I joined in 95. It was never, although I was born into a military family, it was never like forced upon me to, you know, pursue that same career. So I went to school in Surrey, away from sort of that military environment for my last few years. And I always wanted to be a fireman, actually, as a young boy. And when I left school, I think there was 2,000 applicants for one job in the time, the early 90s. So it wasn't really going to happen overnight for me. So I went down to Newquay. I did a lot of surfing as a young boy, and I spent a few weeks down there, which then turned into a few months, and when I was actually supposed to be at college. So my father, long before mobile phones, he came down to look for me, found me, and said, right, what are you going to do now with your life? And I said, I'll join the military. And still quite harsh words, he said, you would last 2 minutes. I was about 9.5 stone soaking wet through and about 5'7", not the sort of man I am today. So I said, all right, I sort of, you know, those words stuck with me. The following day we went back to Aldershot, and I walked into the careers office. Obviously Aldershot at the time was the home of the British Army in the 80s and 90s, and it was very much airborne led with the parachute regiment. So I came out of the careers office, went to meet my father, and I said, yeah, I'm joining. And he said, oh, what are you joining? I said, the parachute regiment. He said, you're not. And he marched me straight back into the careers office. I think he thought my time in the military would be quite short. I know I may not be a lifer, so he wanted me to get the most out of the military. And him being in the Royal Engineers thought, well, why don't you get a trade at least? But I wasn't aware until my father then sat down and explained that within the Royal Engineers, you can also be, you know, part of the airborne units. You can also be part of the commando units with 5-9. If you go 5-9, you could also have your wings and your dagger. And I wasn't aware about, you know, the diving elements of it. So he, for the first time really, he actually sat down and explained in detail a bit more. So that made a bit more sense. And yeah, the following day, you know, I then joined the Royal Engineers.
How old was you at that point?
So I was still about 17 at that time. So by the time I got in, by the time I started training was 17 and a half.
Yeah. And you joined as an adult?
I just joined as an adult, yeah. So I had my 18th birthday through training.
I had my 17th through basic training. It's an experience.
There's better places to have your 18th.
Yeah. Where did you go then? So you did phase one, did the soldiering, phase two, Gibraltar Barracks?
That's it, yeah. Phase one's Bazenbourne, and then phase two was Gibraltar Barracks. And obviously Gibraltar Barracks I was very familiar with because my father was the Sergeant Major, and that was his last post. Two very different sort of careers. My father was the Army manager, player and coach, football. For the military, so, you know, very much at the time known as a tracksuit soldier. He did his tours in Northern Ireland, but majority of his time he's on the football pitch kicking a ball. My first posting from basic was out to Germany to 28 Engineer Regiment, and they were the Army football champions there. So already there was a pattern forming. I think they realised, oh, Stotty's son's in in the Corps. So they flew me out there, and straight away my staff sergeant's like, I'm never going to see you. You're a kiss baller, as he said. And, you know, I ended up doing the PTI course. But after about a year, just under a year that I'd spent there, it was great being in Germany at the time, experiencing, you know, being out in Hammel, you know, the opportunity to, you know, go away skiing at weekends and everything else. And but I could see that I was almost following the path of my father, and I didn't really want to do that. I wanted to sort of pursue the military side of it rather than the sport. And so I then applied to do the commando course, 5-9 commando course. Mm. Unfortunately, just before that, I got into an altercation in Germany, and which soon then ended up with myself being in Colchester prison for a short stint. But I think that was about a couple of weeks before I was due to go over to 5-9 on their beat up. So they'll have a 4-week beat up prior to you going on the All Arms Commander course. And that's sort of like their own selection process, and also get yourself prepared admin wise before you go on the course. So you have to pass that phase before you go on the commander course. 5-9 commander run their own one, 2-9 commander the artillery run theirs as well. And I was on the second week of the beat up, and I had to then fly back to Germany for an ID parade. I got picked out quite easy. Yeah, it didn't help my quite large ears. And so I carried on, did the commander course. And on completion of the commander course, you know, we all sat in the AO's office, you know, and it's congratulating everyone on the, you know, your green beret. And he said, right, you guys are all going across the water, because 5-9 were currently on tour in Northern Ireland. I thought, great. He said, no, not you. You're going back to Germany. And I had to go back and obviously go speak, you know, get charged for this. I could have prolonged it and gone court-martial and probably got away with it. But I was still quite young, and I was just keen, and I just wanted to start a new life with the commando. So yeah, I did 56 days in Colchester prison, and then turned up at 5-9. And great attitude for the admin officer. I remember him, Ian Sinclair. He just picked up my report, ripped it up, threw it in the bin, and said, fresh start. So
oh, brilliant,
yeah, it was good, yeah. So it was almost like draw a line in the sand and move on.
Had you felt at that point, had you felt like you'd let yourself down, or was it just one of those things? It sounds like a trivial thing.
It was just one of those things. You know, I wasn't the only person involved in the altercation. I was the only one that was found out. You know, I obviously kept my mouth shut. And when you sort of go to Colchester prison as well, I think the instructors there as well, they identify, you know, those that, you know, just unfortunately got caught, you know, just unlucky. And then those that, you know, don't want to be in the military, and, you know, any opportunity would go AWOL. So they soon identify, you know, who the threats are and not. And to be honest, I really enjoyed my time at Colchester prison. I was actually learning a lot of military skills. I was doing fitness twice a day. You know, I have an OCD, you know, it must be a military thing. You know, I like everything needs to be neat and in pairs. So that was great in Colchester as well, because everyone else's locker had to be the same. The only downside with Colchester is that they don't pay you. You know, I mean, if they paid me, I would have probably stayed.
A glutton for punishment.
Yeah.
The what was life like then at 5-9? And for those that don't know, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but it is seen as almost the cream of the crop for the Royal Engineers. Yeah. I mean, people will. I wasn't there, but I'll say it from the outside in. Like it was, it is seen like that.
It is, yeah.
And what was life like day to day and week to week?
Yeah, amazing. So I'd joined the unit where, you know, I'd come from Germany. Not taking anything away from the guys there. There are a lot of fit guys over in Germany, and they, you know, they just don't. They have no interest in doing, you know, P Company or the commando course. But you're then sort of now in a group of like-minded individuals who always want to, you know, push themselves to the limits. And I'm very competitive, and it's really healthy competition being in a unit like that, because you are there amongst other, you know, strong individuals and trying to push yourself forward. Not long having come out of Colchester prison, you know, 5-9 commando with the Army Mining Unit boxing champions. So straight away I was thrown into the boxing team, and you know, successful on my fight, which then put me in good stead moving forward with the group. Obviously 5-9 commando part of 3 commander brigade. So I think my first year there I was in Norway. I then did a med trip, and then I was over in the jungle in the Caribbean. So long before obviously 9/11. So you were going on these tours, but they were testing you in all the environments. So it was great experience soldiering wise, and you know, and obviously that then put you in good stead for your future career. So, no, I really did enjoy it. And after a short period of time, actually, so you have 5-9 commando, and then you have a troop within that called recce troop, and you need to be selected for that troop. It's like the elite of 5-9. And, yeah, I was selected for recce troop quite soon, actually, after about a year.
So. And why is it different? Why do you have to be selected?
So they're looking for, obviously, individuals that stand out. It's almost like their own mini selection. They're looking for individuals that are obviously physically capable. And the difference being that you'll go from 5-9 commando, who are troops, you know, troop level, down to recce troop, which are six-man teams. So obviously you need to be able to operate, be a team player, have a bit more mental resilience, because you're the eyes and ears for the brigade. So we then work alongside brigade patrol troop from the Royal Marines, which are their mountain leaders and their snipers. So it's all about image as well. So, you know, the 5-9 don't want to be seen to be weak in front of these sort of individuals. So we'll stick our strongest guys and you know, again, it's that healthy.
What's the role then? What's your role within that?
So your role is the brigade reconnaissance. So what they do is, part of brigade reconnaissance for Free Commando Brigade is the Royal Marines from Brigade Patrol Troop, which are a mixture of mountain leaders and snipers. You have 148 Battery from the Royal Artillery, who are forward operating officers, and they'll obviously do the FOOS, you know, the naval gun strike. I mean, you have the Royal Engineers 5-9 recce. So we'll be there and we'll be able to, we'll be early eyes on, we'll mix in with the teams and we'll identify if there's any engineering tasks that need doing. You know, should it be bridge demolition, route denial, everything else. We're almost you're the eyes and ears reporting back to the brigade commander, so he then can obviously, you know, structure his next plan, whether he gets 5-9 in or not. So it's just an early, you know, early eyes on.
But very specific within that role. So the engineer role that you're taking on. But within the troop, there's also individuals. Everyone's got their individual tasks. Like there's different trades and different what's the word? Different, yeah. Again, different roles.
Yeah.
You went and did the diving course.
Yes.
Talk about that.
So the diving course actually isn't a trade. The diving course within the Royal Engineers is an additional qualification. So it doesn't matter what trade, you have to volunteer for the dive course. I remember being in Germany and it was on orders every week. Anyone want to go do the diving course? But when you go to a unit like 5-9, there's a massive waiting list. There's a huge waiting list because everyone wants to do it. Obviously, there are advantages that you get additional pay. But when I did my basic dive course, it was only £2.65 a day. It wasn't a great leap. I think now it's something like £15 a day. It's a considerable amount because of the risk involved. So I obviously got my name on the list. And again, I was quite fortunate. Having come back from Colchester, the squadron was still in Northern Ireland. So I was on a rear party and it was just, you know, fortunate that I managed to
get... Oh, you got it before the...
Yeah, I got on it. You have to do an aptitude prior to that. So you have to do a week, because obviously before going on the dive course, you have an aptitude at dive school to be able to understand that you're going to be fine underwater, because it is actually quite claustrophobic and it's quite an alien environment. So rather than wasting spaces on the course, they'll run an aptitude and identify those that are comfortable underwater and obviously, you know, physically able to do the job.
Well, I went down and did the aptitude.
Did you?
I couldn't equalise my ears. I just couldn't get it at 10 metres. I just couldn't get it.
Yeah.
But when it's a real arduous course, and this goes to show like why there's a waiting list with you guys down there, and it attracts a certain person. When we were queuing up, the first course, or the course above us, or ahead of us, was coming back in off a run, right. And one of the blokes shit himself.
Oh, really?
On the run.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's actually, you know, you, P Company and the Commando course are very well known, but I genuinely think it's a different type of fitness down there, and it's one of the hardest courses, you know, the military have to offer. It was just not as well known. There was an incident a few years back where a couple of deaths. The guys actually boiled in their bag because they had them running in their dry bags.
Engineer lads,
yeah, and they passed away. They just you know, it's just so it's yeah, it's a great course. So yeah, I did the aptitude and then obviously went on to the dive course. And I, you know, my love for the water since a young child with the surfing, and obviously that's how I ended up later on going to the special boat service. It's just for that love for the water. I just felt comfortable underwater. For me, it wasn't an alien environment. It's an environment I was quite comfortable with. And yeah, so, but you know, there's a lot of jealousy in the military as well, you know, especially when we're in recce troop, because you've got your dagger and your wings, you're already getting para pay, you're then getting dive pay. You know, some of the corporals within recce troop run more money than the sergeant major, especially if they're diving supervisors. Yeah, you know, just because of the additional quality. So it was sometimes seen, you know, as frowned upon. You know, people just call us skivers, not divers, you know what I mean? So, and to retain your qualification, you need to do 4 hours diving every year, every 6 months, which doesn't actually sound a lot, but if you've got a four-man dive team, you've only got one diver in the water, I mean, you know, he's only getting 30, 40 minutes. So it's actually quite difficult to get the 4 hours in. So you need to be, whenever there's any free opportunity or any diving tasks, you need to volunteer yourself forward.
Mm. And then leaving recce troop, you went and became an instructor. Where was you instructing?
So my first instructional post was in recce troop. So at 5'9", you know, as you know, in the military, you always get a guy or two from the troop. You have to go on guard duty at the gate. So recce troop, we were exempt from that within 5'9" at our Royal Marine Base Chivenor. But what we used to do is we used to provide an instructor on the All Arms Commando course down in Limston. So from recce troop, I went down to Limston and was an instructor on the All Arms Commando course. And so you're still part of 5'9" recce. You're just based down there. And you're seen as the ambassador for 5'9" Commando. And that really opened my eyes to the Royal Marines. I'd worked with the Royal Marines in Brigade Patrol Troop. No, I really enjoyed them. But, you know, I mean, we shared a camp with Commando Logistics, and there was a lot of friction between 5'9" and, you know, just healthy banter. There might be a bit of trouble downtown. But actually going down to Limston really opened my eyes how professional and, you know, determined the Royal Marines are. You know, they've had 9 months training. Obviously, we're trying to cram that into 10 weeks. But also the All Arms Commander course was good for the Royal Marines instructors to see how the Army operate as well, because, you know, they call us pongos and things like that. But they then soon realised there's actually, you know, there's a lot of expertise within all the other corps. So I started down Limston, and on my on the very first course, you know, they totally restructured the course from the OC down. They got rid of all the instructors bar the Royal Engineer and the Royal Artillery guy. And obviously, normally this means there's been a monumental mess up somewhere. But what it was there was a lady called Pip Tatsell, she's a female, who's going to do the commando course. She'd already done two attempts before, and this was her third and final attempt. So my first course was when the first female commando course, commando through. So that was a big eye opener for me. Not so much in the fact, you know, she achieved her aim, which was great, but the press and everything else at the time. And I did feel, I think there was 96 students on that course, and the press were just, any time we were out on the bottom field, or Woodbury Common, there'd be press jumping out trying to get images. And
was there pressure then to get her through, or was it just the same standard as everyone else?
There was pressure. There was another lady on the course as well, Katie Bray, and she was trained by the Royal Marine PTIs, and I remember her really being, you know, excelling. She would do everything, you know, everything that was asked of her. The only thing that Katie failed on, she couldn't climb the 30-foot rope. You know, I mean, if she had climbed that 30-foot rope, I don't think there'd been any qualms from the instructors about her passing, because she was really good and threw everything into it. You know, she had that commando spirit. I think with the other student, she knew the system, and she knew if she had an injury or something, you know, she'd get maybe a couple of days light duty. So there was that sort of games going on. But, you know, she passed the course, and you know, she earned her green beret. So, you know, you can't change history. And, you know, I mean, some of the female, you know, opened my eyes how strong mentally and physically the females are as well. Everyone's quick to sort of, you know, throw mud. But, you know, for me, if they're capable and they can do the job, then yes, they earn their berets. So, yeah, she earned hers. But politically going on in the background, which no one was really aware, because at the time, the guys were out in Afghan on one of the first tours, and we were getting blueies and letters on the training team saying, oh yeah, well done. You know, I mean, you know, I remember from some of the guys from Hereford were like, yeah, don't even bother coming on selection, you've let us down, you know, all that sort of banter anyway, which, you know, I take lightly. But what people weren't aware of what was going on in the background is that Whitehall were looking at this course, and again, whether the MOD's under pressure as well, you know, to get a female through and to be looking like, you know, opening, you know, going the right way, PC. So they were going to actually lower the standard. If a female hadn't passed in the next 12 months, they were going to lower the standards of the All Arms Commando course to a standard till a female passed. And whatever that standard was going to be the standard then moving forward for males and females. So for Pip Tassel to pass, actually, you know, did us a favour, because the standards haven't dropped. So that's sort of the pressures that are going on in the background, which people don't see. Mm. And I don't know whether that's so that the MOD can, you know, tick that box that yes, we have a female now in the commando units. But although she did the commando course, she still cannot fight on the front line. Obviously, lately they've sort of changed that now, opened the door to the infantry. But this is back in 2002. So although she put herself through all that heartache and pain, she still then couldn't operate on the front lines.
So. Oh, it's an interesting perspective, mate, especially from your side as the instructor. I mean, you mentioned there two things. You mentioned selection, you mentioned standards. Is it 2006 you went on selection?
That's it, yeah.
Can you take us from there?
Yeah. So I actually, after about 8 years of being in 5-9, the sergeant majors like that, because my time in Limpson on the training team was actually classed as a posting, although I was still part of the unit. So I did 8 years, which is unheard of really within the Corps. So I'd gone from sapper to sergeant within one unit. And they said, you need to leave now, you know, to pursue your career and, you know, to better your career. You need to go away, get experience and come back at a future date. So I'd actually applied to go for Pathfinders. You know, I mean, it's obviously the airborne equivalent of the Brigade Recce Force. And I thought, well, I'll do that. And my sergeant major called me in and he said, right, Glasgow, who do the manning and records, they're sending you to the dive school as a senior dive instructor. Because at the time there'd been a number of incidents, not so much with the engineer divers, but with the Royal Navy divers, and been a few deaths. So obviously now, from when I did my original dive course back in 1998, and you're now in 2005, within that period, diving had changed completely, health and safety. When I, in 1998, the communications was with a lifeline around your chest, just doing pulls and bells. And that's how you communicate.
Literally pulling a rope.
Pulling a rope, bell. And you feel the pull on your chest, and you then respond with your pulls and bells. Now, with health and safety and everything else, you couldn't put a diver in the water unless you had two-way voice communications and video. So, you know, health and safety had really sort of taken over the diving world. So because of these incidents, they introduced some new diving equipment. And to not disrupt the ongoing courses, myself and three others, myself being the senior diving instructor, moved into the dive school to train those divers that were already trained within the Corps. So that wasn't the plan. That was that was literally told, right, no change of plan. You're off to Portsmouth. So which is fine. It's, you know, it's a great environment. And again, I love being in the water, but you know, I didn't go the route of Pathfinder. So I then decided to go on selection. It's quite sociable, actually, the diving environment. So obviously I was taking these guys through the courses, and every 2 weeks you get and some guys that you know anyway. So it was almost like a full-on party reunion. So yeah, but my first 2 months was, alcohol induced. So I just decided, right, as a Monday I'll stop, I'll put in for selection. And that's what I did. I just trained every day. I just got on a spin bike and just did 2 hours of that with a Bergen on my back. I'd attempted selection earlier on back in 2002, and I got a medical discharge on the mountains. And the lessons learned from then, I was running up and down the coastal paths of North Devon with big weights on my back. Yes, it has an effect, but when I then was on the hills, it had a long-term effect on my knee and actually tore my lateral meniscus. So having come off selection within 5 days, I had an operation, and 6 weeks later, I was back up running again. So I didn't want to repeat that sort of training pattern. So I decided, right, low impact, I'll go on one of these spinner bikes. And that's all I did. That was my training. All I did was 6 weeks for 2 hours a night on the spinner bike. And strange enough, at the age of 28, I got my fastest BFT. You know, it was 7 minutes. And I was like, wow. So this new sort of training regime worked for me, and it was, you know, low impact. It wasn't, you know, hindering my knee as well. So I went to do the briefing course. You have to do a briefing course before you go on selection. So it's a bit like the beat up with 5'9". You spend a week, or an aptitude at the dive school. You're doing a week with the SBS. You do a few testing marches, maybe a swim test, a bit of mat read and everything else. And they'll let you know where you are, whether they think you should go on the next course or whether you should do a bit more training. And they'll offer advice. And the reason for that is it's not, again, a process to dwindle numbers. You only have two attempts on selection. And of past, people weren't really aware of what selection entailed. So they would come and then maybe fail on fitness, maybe fail on something like navigation. And that's one life, and you only have one more life. So this briefing course sort of eliminates that. They'll get you to a point and say, right, you can now go on selection. So you're not wasting any sort of lives on there. So I did the briefing course at Poole, and then the following week I did the briefing course at Hereford. I did one and went down to Hereford to do theirs. And straight away, it was the summer, and I was just naturally attracted to Poole. I liked the way that, you know, we got shown around camp. The guys are walking around in blue shorts, t-shirts. They've got Oakleys on, you know, and like reef sandals. And I was like, perfect. You know, this is the sort of environment I want.
Like being 16 on the beach.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I was like, this is an environment I want to be in. But at the time, they'd only opened the course tri service. Like prior to this, you know, 100% of the special boat service are Royal Marines, and so the normal route for anyone in the army is always the SAS. But they've now just opened the doors tri service, and the reason for that is a lot of Marines who didn't like diving didn't want to go to pool, so they would go to the SAS. Mm. So the SBS were losing a pool of guys to the SAS because of the diving element. So they then opened the doors tri-service. And obviously Royal Engineers, we have like 400 divers, and 5'9 Commando, the, you know, majority of those guys are divers. So there's a lot of the guys were sort of attracted to go to pool. So that was the reasoning for opening those doors up. So it was so I was one of the first guys to attempt.
Is the process similar then?
Exactly the same. The same process. You do your briefing course with both units. Yeah. And it's a joint selection. As of 1994, they made it a joint selection. So it's all part of UK Special Forces. So there's no difference. The only difference being when you finish, if successful at 6 months, you get your sandy berry and your blue belt. We get our green berry and belt. And then you go to your relevant units. And then you continue.
So are the full 6 months?
Full 6 months. Exactly the same course. Exactly the same selection process, which people aren't really aware of. Which is good, because then obviously, moving forward, when you're with the units, there's a lot of stuff you do together anyway. So you tend to... Everyone knows the standards, the same SOPs. But you also know the guys as well, because you've probably done selection with them. Some of my best friends now were guys I was on selection with in Hereford. So there is no difference at all. You know, Hereford, go once you finish, you then go back to Poole, and you'll then go do your boat and diving phase.
Can you talk about what happens next then? After the first 6 months, it's pretty well documented. Mm. What happens? Can you speak about what happens at Poole? Like, in you can be as
yeah. It's one of the things I was when you do selection, it's like 6 months of your life, and it's testing. It's not like any other course. Like some, you know, the commando course, the dive course. You know, instructors will shout motivation, and you know the instructors here give you no motivation. It's minimum contact. They'll tell you to do something, and you just do it. You know, you need to be able to retain information. They don't want to keep repeating. So that's a big difference on selection compared to other courses. And individuals have to be sort of self-motivated. You have to have a sense of humor. You need a sense of humor on a course like that. But when you finish, you know, for 6 months, you think, wow, you know, I mean, I'm now in probably the most elite club in the world. I mean, you turn up at pool on Monday and it's like, yeah, you're the new boy. It's like, for you, you think the world has stopped because while you've been on selection. It hasn't. And when you're in the, as I call it, the green army, you're always finding out who's on selection, who's successfully passed. You know, it's always something to aspire to. When you're actually in the unit itself, you actually forget about selection. You're now at the start point, and they train you enough that you can slot in to one of the troops. But then your training starts then. You then have evolving all the time. So it's a strange environment. You think, oh yeah, I'm at the top of my game. In fact, you've gone back in. So you also lose your rank. So I was a sergeant when I did selection. I'm now a trooper again. Mm. So you start that whole process again.
Are you being kind of ushered into like the diving side of things, or is it just like blank again? Do you have to still get your 4 hours in?
It's totally different diving. So it's a different diving from the Royal Engineers diving completely. So the Royal Engineers diving is air diving. The SPS diving is 100% O2. So you can't go deeper than 7 meters because it's toxic. So they're actually swimmers, not divers. They're known as combat swimmers. and the difference being the Royal Engineer divers, anything you do on the surface. So, you know, we do everything underwater, concreting, you know, chainsaws, and all the engineering tools or the hydraulic tools. With the SBS, it's an insertion method, and that's what it is. So it's swimming. But
so there's no one on top making sure you're all right?
No, there's no one. Yeah, there's no one. No, there's no communications and things like that. So, but they have their own sort of ways of doing it. And very difficult for a diving supervisor to monitor because of the rebreather, which is self-contained. It gives off no bubbles. So you won't see the divers. You have to sort of guesstimate when in training where the divers are. You know, I think the figures are, you know, you swim 100 meters in 4 minutes fully kitted, so the supervisor sort of almost has to guess where you are, as long as you're going in the right direction on the compass board. And there's been instances where the guys aren't there, they're further, you know, they've probably left the harbour wall. But my thought process for going to Poole rather than Hereford is because of my diving background, I thought if I go to Hereford, I'm going to end up in boat troop, you know, and being given all the dive tasks. I thought, well, everyone in the SBS are divers, so we know we're on a level playing field. And that's not the case. So these guys in Poole, they're new to diving as well. So as soon as when they finish their selection, they then go do their diving course. So me going there as a senior dive instructor, actually, I was, you know, a lot more current, or I was known as the guru. So, yeah, I was then given the role of, you know, the dive rep for the squadron. Mm. So
and was you well respected, as in was the a kind of was you deemed not lower but like to the side because you was from the army?
No, not at all. No, not at all. And I'm quite a you know, I'm quite humorous and banter, and I'll give as good as I get. So I was probably quite a good candidate, one of the first candidates to go down. Mm. Because, you know, if I saw any of that, I just rip into them. So, but it's that healthy banter. You know, you get the old pongo here and there, and you know what I mean? But I remember on my briefing course, you know, the officers had to do their estimates in the evening, and, you know, stop us going out downtown. We had to write a one pager on why we wanted to be in the special boat service, and I said, oh, because I like my nickname Person Pongo, you know what I mean? I just want to come down here and keep it. But no, there was none of that at all, because the majority of the guys as well that were probably from the Brigade Recce Force anyway, and they'd worked alongside us beforehand. And I think that sort of selection sort of eliminates any sort of issues that you're seen below anyone else. You know, you've passed that standard and everything. You know, so for you to do that, you've obviously got something about you. So, you know, you're not looked down on at all.
Did you thrive in that environment?
Yeah, I loved the environment. Yeah, again, I talked about 5'9", going to an environment there where everyone's, you know, is competitive. You know what I mean? You then find yourself at 5'9", you know, being at the front and standing out. You're now in an environment again where you're competing with, again, with like-minded individuals. And yeah, there's some of these guys as well, they're just, you know, self-motivated, and you know, it's it's an environment. It's probably where I was my most comfortable when I got there. I was at my most comfortable.
That was, so you passed the initial selection December 2006, so you then went to pool 2007.
Like? Yeah. December 2008, you go straight to pool. Pool. Yeah, as soon as you finish, you get, you get badged, and then that's you straight into the squadrons.
And amongst that time, you did various operations. April 2010, you sustained an injury, a parachuting injury.
Yeah,
which then was kind of the beginning of the end, really.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, so obviously I came at a time in the Special Forces, probably at one of its busiest times in the world, in the fight on global terrorism. You know, it was at its height. You know, the units were in the Middle East. I obviously don't need to name countries, but it's quite obvious. But yeah, it was at a period where, you know, I mean, I was doing everything. You know, you see these kids at home playing, was it COD, Call of Duty? You know, I was living and breathing that. You know, we were, you know, jumping out of planes, you know, diving on the oil rigs. You know, we were doing what you see on the movies. And so yeah, for me, I was probably the highlight of my career at that point. And I was doing a training jump to then go back out pre-deployment training. And as I exited the aircraft, my leg got caught up in the rigging line. We were doing a halo jump. So it's high altitude, low opening. So as I looked up, I was trying to free my leg before the rigging line went taut and opened my chute. And frantically trying to shake it out, and I couldn't. And my leg ripped up over my head and to the right. And instantaneously, that pain, you know, I knew something was wrong. Thankfully, my leg had freed, and it hadn't sort of ripped off, because I still had to then travel 30 minutes through the air to get to the DZ, and I was drifting in and out of consciousness at the time as well, but just trying to keep an eye on the rest of the guys. And obviously my first challenge was to actually land this thing, so I did a couple of loops over the DZ just to really gauge the right directions of the wind, and I came in, it was a perfect landing. I landed on one leg, but because of the injuries, I actually tore my ACL, my MCL, my lateral meniscus in my knee, my hamstring and my calf, and all the supporting muscles. So I literally ripped everything. But during that period, you know, the recovery period, you hear about rugby players that tear their cruciate ligaments in their knee and they're still playing without it. You know, you need to get, you know, rehab straight away. But the volcanic ash, the volcano was grounded all the aircraft. So I couldn't get an Aeromed flight in for me for about 6 weeks.
Where was you at this point?
We were in Oman.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so that was it. I was just in a hotel on painkillers. I came back, got flown back to Selly Oak, sent home for 6 weeks, came back down, and then this is when the start of sort of the spiral, really. They then lost my MRI scans, and this just went on for the next quite a few months, actually. I'd go to hospitals and have hospital appointments, and then they say, oh, such and such is on holiday. You know, I mean, it just a comedy of errors, really. And unfortunately, yeah, that was me. I then had to leave the military.
Is that frustrating?
That is frustrating, yeah, because, excuse me, you know, I talk about my previous injury on selection. It took 5 days to have that operation, and within 6 weeks, I'm running again. And you seem to be the top of your game here within the Special Forces. And it was just, I don't know whether, but it was just, you know what I mean, at the time, you know, you had, Iraq was going on, you had Afghanistan, you had, obviously, guys and girls with life-changing injuries, obviously a lot more than mine, you know what I mean? Obviously, were they the priority? You just don't know. It just seemed to be a comedy of errors, really, and it was frustrating. It was really frustrating. I'd given up 16 years of my life for this, for this, and they couldn't even be bothered to get me fixed. So in the end, I actually got the operation in the end, only because I was threatening legal in the end. We got it through, and I was now due to leave the military, and my biggest worry at this point is my wife is now 8 months pregnant, and I'm now leaving the military. It's like, you know, what do I do now? How am I going to support my family? You know, I mean, you know, the great thing about, excuse me, the military is you know, you are paid each month, you know what I mean, regardless, there's no sort of delays. So you don't really need to worry financially there. But now I was entering into a world that was alien to me. I hadn't been a civilian since I was 17. So the military, like your mother, your father, you know, they feed you, they clothe you, they pay you on time. They sort of do everything, sort of take away those other distractions. You can continue with your job. Transitioning for me was actually a lot smoother than I thought, because my wife's very entrepreneurial. She used to run all the Santander banks in Aberdeen at the time. So, you know, I mean, when I was in the military, I didn't know what council tax band I was on. I didn't really care. But she set up my first company on a BlackBerry watching EastEnders. You know, I mean, you know, for me, that's like probably 3 months of paperwork. Again, with the military, you know, when you do your career transition, I think it's something that needs to change, really. You know, they give you, talk about CVs and interview techniques. Well, I've never written a CV and I've never had an interview. But there's all those other skills that probably the civilians take for granted. You know, who do I speak to about my council? Who do I speak to about the heating? That's them things. So fortunately, Alana took that away from me, and that helped. And within 48 hours of leaving, I got a phone call, and it was the Arab Spring in 2011. And my friend said, look, any chance you can assist me in Benghazi? I've got a huge contract. And it was the DFID contract, Department of Institute Development, which was David Cameron's baby. It was their very first project. So he needed someone to fly in an advance party to, you know, get things set up, because they're going to fly 30 security guys in the following week. So straight away, I know you're supposed to go on gardening leave for 6 weeks, but I just, you know, I took that opportunity and flew straight out to Libya. And I spent a couple of weeks there. And what I soon identified in Libya, and again, you've gone from the world of the military and you're now in this sort of private security sector. So I was always learning. And what I soon identified in Libya, that it wasn't, the Libyans didn't want it to be your next Afghanistan or Iraq. They didn't want private security companies coming in carrying weapons. Now, we were given weapons. You know, I was given weapons if we needed them, and I actually didn't need them because the locals were providing security for us. And, you know, I mean, it's quite intimidating if we are then also walking around with weapons either. You know, it's trying to gauge the atmospherics. And from my time, the first week I was there, before the rest of the guys flew in, I'd sort of, you know, gauge that there was no threat to us. But yeah, they were really keen that it was not your next Afghanistan or Iraq. So there was a huge proliferation of weapons at the time as well. And I was looking as well at some of these security companies, and some of these security companies, you know, they're getting paid six figures, you know, to look after some of these oil and gas, some of these NGOs, these Westerners. And then, you know, they have these crisis management plans in place. And at this time, I was also trying to find a niche. A lot of my friends had set up their private security companies in Poole, you know, maritime security, and I didn't want to really get into that. I was now living in Aberdeen. My wife and I live in Aberdeen, so we couldn't get any way further. So I soon identified that these guys, what they were claiming to have and what they actually had were two different things. And should something go wrong, you know what I mean, you know, something drastic goes wrong, someone's going to get found out. So I flew home after 2 weeks. Alana gave birth to our first daughter, Molly. And then I decided to then fly back into Libya. And then I bought 30 weapons and I buried them between Tunis and Egypt and started making case reports and writing evacuation plans. You know, evacuation from the road, by air, or by sea.
Just a diligence.
Sorry?
Why was that? Just a diligence? Just because the uprising was going on? What was
Yeah, just because I'd seen an opportunity in the market.
Right.
At the time, there's a huge proliferation of weapons, so they're quite easy to source. But that wasn't, you know, once Gaddafi had fallen in Tripoli, you know, I mean, they were going to take control.
The opportunity was evacuation.
The opportunity, what I saw was evacuation. Yeah. That's what I saw for long term, because once, you know, Gaddafi was still in Tripoli at this point, you know, once Gaddafi fell, there's a huge opportunity there for Westerners, for oil and gas to come in. But again, they didn't want any private security having weapons. So, and I generally believe that you shouldn't need weapons anyway, but I wanted to have an opportunity that should they ever be needed, that I knew where they were if we needed them. So my sort of long-term plan was what we, you know, we would do is we would drive in from Egypt or Tunis, cross the borders, you know, no weapons. If we don't need weapons, then fine. But if we do, then I have a few caches. And within those caches, I would also stash some money and some communications kit. And it was just something I'd taken from my time in the Special Forces. You know, it's there if you need, But you know, I mean, hopefully I didn't need it. Mm. And that's what I did. I wrote evacuation plans, and I sold my plans to somebody, oil and gas, and got retainers, and that was great. And I sort of then forgot about those weapons. And then there was various other tasks which were great. We had the London Olympics here. That's probably the only job I've ever done here in the UK. But post that, I then got a phone call. Could I go back out to Libya? And I was out in Libya. Unfortunately, I was actually in Benghazi at the same time. And it was the, I think, 11th of September. And the American ambassador had got killed in Benghazi. They'd overrun the embassy. I think they made a film 13 hours.
The Battle of Benghazi.
The Battle of Benghazi. Mm. So I was in Benghazi at the time, and I was asked, could I assist a German oil company, KCA Deutag? So I got KCA Deutag safely through safe houses back to Tripoli. Again, I didn't really need any weapons. There was no real threat to us, but it was just...
How many people was that?
So there was 8 of us in total. And then we had the local drivers. But it's also understanding the demographics of the country, you know, the political issues as well. So Libya is a great country, and it's, you know, it's frustrating to see. Obviously, it's still taking its time. It has potential of being the Dubai of the Mediterranean. It's the 7th largest oil rich country in the world. But the problem you've got there, there's 167 tribes, and they all want a piece. But it's knowing about these tribes and these militias and, you know, who's leading them. So I pulled the guys out of Benghazi and I put them in a safe house in Zella. And the drivers that we had were from Benghazi, and there's no way that I could take them to Tripoli, you know, because just having them would just cause issues. So unaware to them, I had drivers coming in from Tripoli at the same time. And I remember the morning that we were due to leave, and it was like, almost like a standoff, a Western standoff. You know, the drivers then noticed these other drivers were coming in. They thought, I said, look, you will get paid. I goes, but I cannot take you to Benghazi. You are a risk to this operation. So, but a lot of other companies may not have looked at it like that. They would have probably just straight away just driven straight in and may come across issues. Mm. So I had a quite a good knowledge and understanding of the country, the militias and everything else. And, so that was a successful task. And then, you know, I did other tasks around the world. What I liked to do was ad hoc as well. So each time I got a phone call, it was always a different task. You know, I was out in Kurdistan training the Kurdish Special Forces, doing 4 weeks training there. We then trained their close protection team. Next thing you get a phone call, you're off to Guinea. Can you be a close protection officer? So, but what it was, I enjoyed that because I was getting experiences, you know, within the security sector. It wasn't just doing a rotation.
Was you spending time with your daughter as well? Was you managing to
it
get
was
that?
It, I wasn't, and it's something that I'll talk about later on. So I got to, and then in 2014 I was out in, we'd done the London Olympics here for Visa. They were the main sponsor, and they asked if we would go to Brazil and do the World Cup, of course. So again, a great job. And what I soon found in the security sector, that actually the risk reward ratio isn't even. You know, I would probably be on more money in Brazil in a 5-star hotel with no risk than I would be on a day rate in Somalia or Yemen. And that's one thing I really identified. But I was in Brazil at the time, and then I got a phone call. And basically, it was called the Tripoli War. So you talked about a Benghazi battle. It's now the Tripoli War. The government and the Zintani rebels had come to loggerheads, and they were having a fight in and around Tripoli. And the battle ended in the Tripoli airport, and they burnt down the airport and everything else. So all the embassies had shut shop and gone. The Canadian embassy, however, was still in country. And what it is... a lot of these embassies are in countries due to trade and investment. They're seeing opportunities, you know, for themselves. And I think it was October. This was July 2014. I think October 13, the Canadians had identified that there was not going to be any trade and investment for a good 10 to 15 years. And for $20 million a year to keep an embassy open, you know, they thought, right, we'll shut shop and go. But they needed a window of opportunity to go. They couldn't just leave because there'd be questions asked. So when the Tripoli War happened and the Americans shot, the British shot, and they all left, the Canadians were stuck behind. But their close protection team, it was a Canadian military, but they rotated every 4 months and they used to fly in and out of the Tripoli International Airport. Obviously, the airport's now burnt down. But part of their remit on in Libya, they never left Tripoli. So outside of Tripoli, they didn't really know Libya at all. So they were now, you know, the guys were shredding the paperwork in the office. And
it like that?
It was like that. They're not coming back. Yeah, they're not coming back. So they were shredding. That's why they were delayed. So I got the phone call, Dean, can you help us? So I flew from Brazil back to UK and then bound straight into Libya, into Tripoli. So there was 18 military, 4 diplomats and a cat. And
get the cat out.
Yeah, you had to get the cat out, yeah, for one of the diplomats. Probably more hassle than it's worth. So I sat down for a couple of days and I know I'd already evacuated a few NGOs as well during those couple of days as well. And I sat down, I gave them a full set of military orders, especially for the military guys, almost to give them that sort of comfort that they knew, you know, this wasn't, you know, on the back of a fag packet, this had actually been fought about. And yeah, I single-handedly evacuated the Canadian embassy, 18 military and 4 diplomats back to Tunis.
Yeah. On
along the coastal road, yeah. So it's actually from Tripoli to Tunis is only 100 kilometres. But again, it's knowing who to talk to along the way, having the right militias. And my fixer, he's from Zuwara, which is the border. So he knew his brother and also his cousin was the president of the GNC, the government. So it's having the right fixers in the right places. And I think when the Brits left Tripoli, they actually got engaged on by a few of the militia. I think it was just a bit of a miscommunication. But that sort of obviously put a bit of fear into the Canadians. It was like it was a camp just outside to the west of Tripoli. So me and my fixer went to speak to the militias, speak to the guys that were involved. And, you know, they explained, it was just, you know, miscommunication. They didn't slow down at, you know, rightfully so. So their guys probably did the right thing, didn't slow down at the checkpoints, just motored through, which is probably an error on the security team in charge of the British Embassy. So we spoke to them, explained about our movement, what we're going to be doing. And, to ease the Canadians, they actually escorted us through. which was nice as well. And that's what a lot of, I think in the private security, a lot of people get, you know, people think, right, you know, we need to wear sunglasses and, you know, have all the Gucci gear and, you know, this is the way we'll do it. It's actually just communicating with the right people. You know, people just like to be informed.
Everything you're saying, you know, from almost leaving in 2011 is all about good communication, minimum force, using your intellect, and really good logistics, excellent planning,
meticulous planning, and that's it. And like, you know, sound on this podcast sounds wow, amazing. This guy evacuated, you know, 22 people and a cat, and it was actually quite simple. I was in the vehicle further ahead, and I was just at the checkpoints, and I'd driven that many a time, and I knew most of the guys. But if there's a different guy on guard, you know, you may give them a few dollars, and then they'll just wave it by.
You say it's simple, but there's a lot before.
There is a lot before, and it's also the timing of it as well. You know, midday is when most people are going to be at the borders. And we went before first light, so most people are still asleep. So the majority of those guard points, there was no man in them anyway.
So we talk about meticulous planning. April 2016, you applied to Guinness for a world record attempt. So you've gone totally off piece now, away from the security industry, and have really moved us. The world record attempt was to cycle the longest motorable road in the world.
That's it.
14,000 miles, the
Pan American Highway, yeah.
Argentina to Alaska.
Yeah.
If you Google the map, because I was like, all right, 14,000. I Googled the map on the way in. I was like, fuck it.
Yeah. I think, so how that sort of came about is actually post the Canadian embassy. I'd come back from that trip, and me and my wife sat down, and you mentioned it earlier about the family life, juggling family. I hadn't juggled it correctly. I'd only been home 21 days that year because I was just fixated on, developing my security company.
For cash?
just for cash and probably just for keep my sanity. Yeah. You know, I needed to do something. I mean, me and my wife sat down and we soon realized that, you know, my father had passed away as well not long before the Brazil World Cup, and we hadn't even really talked about that either. I was just, you know, I was just fixated. And what I hadn't done, I actually was trying to match the adrenaline rush I had when I was in the Special Forces. Mm. But I didn't have the support network around me. I didn't have the guys around me. I didn't have the aircraft available. You know what I mean? I didn't have those weaponry systems. And yeah, that then really hit home that I hadn't really addressed the transition to Civvy Street. And my wife now is a property developer. So we sort of sat down and she said, well, you don't need to go away. She goes, look, you know, spend some more time at home. I said, yeah, perfect. So I started doing property developing with my wife. And at this time, I during this period in the private security, I'd pretty much neglected my own physical well-being. So I bought a push bike and I cycled from our house to Aberdeen, about 8 miles and 8 miles home. And straight away, I was feeling, you know, a lot better. So it wasn't big miles at all, but, you know, just being out and being active, you know, I felt a lot better. And you can imagine from my backstory, you know, after a month sat in these architects and planners meetings, you know, I mean, I wasn't interested in the heating system of the building or the plumbing system. I was more interested in the coffee and the biscuits. So my wife could see that glaze over my eyes and she thought, right, he's going to be back in the desert again burying weapons. So she said, well, you need to do something, you know, to keep yourself physically, mentally engaged. And I was 39 at the time and I was approaching my 40th birthday, and then I made a ground rush. And she said, well, was it... when do you fancy doing something? I said, oh, I fancy doing a world record. And she said, well, what? And obviously I'm restricted because of my knee with the running, so I can't run anymore. So I said, well, I enjoy cycling. You know, I've only just started cycling. So, I was thinking more like Aberdeen to Dundee. And then my wife then found the Pan America Highway. Yeah, and as you've just touched on there, it's 14,000 miles. Mm. It's the longest road in the world. And to put it into context, it's the equivalent of cycling from London to Sydney and then 4,000 miles. It's 15 Land's End John O'Groats back to back, or 5.5 Tour de France's. And I just thought, perfect, because of the sort of detail and planning we're doing the Special Forces, I did in the private security. This wasn't just a physical feat. It was actually... as a big planning feat as well. Mm. You know, I mean, you're going through two continents, 13 countries, everything from, you know, I cycled everything from plus 47 degrees in the Atacama Desert to minus 18. And I thought, yeah, this is the perfect challenge for me. So I applied for the world record, still having only cycled about 20 miles. And Guinness came back and said, yes, you've been successful in your application. I was like, okay, great. So, a bit of name dropping here. I'm quite good friends with Prince Harry. So him and I had done a lot actually for charity before. I was the SBS ambassador for Scotland. So he would like be a guest sometimes at some events for me. So we'd done stuff behind closed doors. And I explained what I was doing. I said, look, I've applied for this world record. What's your thoughts? And this was 2016. And he said, would I mind doing it for Heads Together? Heads Together was a campaign we were going to launch in 2017. Obviously, it was... to tackle mental health.
Yeah.
Obviously, I was aware of mental health within the military. And then when we sort of sat down and discussed, you know, what it entailed, I wasn't aware how big an issue this was throughout, you know, all societies. You know, mental health doesn't discriminate. You know, doesn't care who you are, or, you know, what you've done. You know what I mean? It affects everyone. So I thought, perfect, that's the perfect challenge. And then I got introduced to Heads Together at the Royal Foundation, and they said, right, how much are you looking at raising? And I said, £1 million. So for me, the challenge, you know, what we're trying to raise had to match the enormity of the challenge. So that's why I came up with that number. And then I was then asked, well, what is the message we're trying to promote? And obviously Heads Together is very good about, it's all about communication. So there's three ways of tackling sort of mental health. You know, there's communication, which is key. There's medication, which obviously we're trying to avoid. And I said, well, physical activity. Physical activity helps your mental state. And I was actually told during one of those meetings, oh, you can't use that quote. I said, why? And they said, because it's not been scientifically proven. I said, yeah, but I don't need a scientist to tell me that I feel good when I'm cycling. So I ignored them anyway and carried on promoting the message. So that was the message that we were promoting. And that was the start of the Pan America Highway Challenge. So I then gave myself a year to train. I was doing the planning and give myself a year to train, yeah.
No, carry on, mate.
So, yeah,
no,
and the... And obviously, you can imagine, everyone thinks, you know, that there's the physical aspect, there's the planning aspect. There's also a thing that was new to me was the PR and marketing, social media. I'd come from an environment where social media was a taboo. You know, and now I'm having to, you know, self-promote, which was, again, alien to me. You've then got the fundraising element, and then you've got the sponsorship element. So there's actually a lot involved in a challenge like this rather than just getting on the bike and cycling. But you can imagine trying to get sponsorship. I'm walking into some of these big companies, and, you know, I said, right, yes, I've never cycled before. I'm going to break the world record for the longest road. I'm going to raise £1 million for mental health. I think a lot of them thought I had mental health problems and sort of showed me the door. But then a few sponsors came on board, or Bayer Bikes, they came on board. They loved the concept. And yeah, no, being a non-cyclist, they made me an ambassador for one of the biggest bike brands in the world. Wasn't that amazing? And with my sponsored marketing, when we did the SWOT analysis, the only weakness that came back at the start of the challenge was my arrogance towards the cycling community. And, you know, I mean, no one in the cycling community has ever said that, and it was never meant to be, you know, but... you know, that was the only thing that sort of came back as the weakness. And then I got a main sponsor probably about 8 months into my training. It was St. James's Place Wealth Management. They have a charitable foundation, and they were looking at getting the mental health at that time as well. So there was just great alignment there. And that took a huge amount of pressure off. You know, at this time, I'd funded 50,000 of my own money.
Was the sponsorship to sponsor you actually physically doing the event, like the logistics around it, all the the food, the visa, all that kind of stuff?
Everything you don't see, yeah. Not the donation. So my plan was to raise £1 million, but what I'd sort of looked into with charities is, you know, the money that goes in and the money that's impacted, you know, there's a bit of a percentage, you know, obviously for admin costs, wages and things like that. I did this at no cost. So every penny we raised went to charity. So we raised £900,000 for every charity. Because St. James's Place had come on, they, you know, as the main sponsor, that assisted us because they covered all those other costs. Obviously, I paid, before St. James's Place came on, I'd used £50,000 of my own money. So my wife's sort of looking at me as I'm burning our money. She's like, you better get a sponsor.
She mentioned, hey, she brought it up.
Yeah. But when Guinness came back, actually, and said, right, you've been successful, you know, within a week, I decided to do a 100-mile bike ride. And I thought, yeah, okay, you know, it's quite difficult. And then within 3 weeks, I thought, well, why not do Land's End John O'Groats? You know, without sounding arrogant, I know it's a lot of people's bucket list, but for me, it had to be a training ride. And I did it in the November. And, you know, I had first 2 days of Storm Angus down in the southwest. I fell off my bike in Somerset and damaged my wrist. I got to Moffat in Scotland. It was -16. And everyone said to me, oh, you need to be bike fit. I'd only been cycling 3 weeks. And I thought bike fit was, you know, fitness. I said that will come with time, and it's not knowing that bike fit was actually the measurements for your bike. So I didn't really know much about cycling, but for me mentally, I had to, if I couldn't do one Land's End John O'Groats, how was I going to do 15? But that was a lot, quite difficult. But Harry and I, when we did the promo video for the Pan America Highway, so he, the Duke, did a promo video with me to help promote it. We talked about the training, and he said, would I involve the Endeavour Fund, which Wise is part of the Military Element Royal Foundation? And I said, yeah, of course. I said, I'm doing Land's End John O'Groats, let them come along. So that was my first training ride. I mean, 6 months later, we did it reverse. I did John O'Groats, Land's End. But at this point, I knew about cadence. I knew about cycling. You know, and I was actually bike fit at this point. And mentally, that was a big hurdle for me, because it was quite difficult, the first Land's End John O'Groats. But this one, well, again, sounding arrogant, was quite easy. And it had to be easy. The rest of my training as well, part of the planning, I'd looked into, you know, the climates and the conditions that I was going through. You know, the Atacama Desert in Chile is the driest non-popular desert in the world. It's where they film all these Mars films, you know. And so I was going through there. So I needed to satisfy myself that I could cope in those sort of environments. So I flew out to Dubai and did some training out in Dubai. You know, got myself on the bike for about 8 hours a day, you know, ticking that box. I, you know, my body could cope at heat. Yes, I knew it could because of my time in the military, but I wasn't on the bike in the military. There's a place here in London, the Altitude Centre. So obviously to try not disrupt my training, when I was coming down to meet charities and sponsors from Scotland, they would let me use their facilities just off bank, and the rooms simulated at altitude. Mm. So you go in there and you can use the bike or the running machines. So I decided to do a 10-hour bike ride, static bike. Oh, probably one of the hardest things I've done. You know, luckily I'm quite vain and there was a mirror in front of me and look at myself for 10 hours. But you know what I mean? I then ticked that box that I could cycle at altitude for a long period of time. And yeah. Again, put in sort of context, the biggest climb on the Tour de France is about 21 kilometers. The biggest climb we have here in UK is west coast of Scotland is 12 kilometers. My biggest climb was 67 kilometers. And it was from sea level to plus 4,000 meters in a day.
Really?
Yeah, 4,000. It's huge. So anything that we have in Europe, you know, the Pan American Highway, just put it on steroids. It's just huge.
We can't go into it all today. No. And you've got a book coming out in the future. Yes. And I'm sure that goes really into it. Delves right into every element of it. It's too vast to cover in this podcast. Mm. But you smashed two records.
Yes.
The first one was that South America, and then the whole thing.
That's
was it.
Yeah. South America, I beat by 10 days. Yeah,
and then the overall was.
I mean, I beat by 17. So.
And what was there's a nice little kind of mini story within it, but you received a letter for the royal wedding.
That was it. Yeah. So when I did my research and planning, I spoke to a few of the previous record holders, and I learned a lot from them. And one of the guys, when I applied for the world record, it was 125 days, Scott Napier. By the time Guinness had got back to me, Carlos from Mexico had beaten it, and it was 117 days. I was planning for 110 days. Mm. And it wasn't because I thought, right, I'm going to smash it. I'd given myself that fudge factor. So should there be an issue that's out of our control, should it be, maybe an earthquake or political issues as well. If there's a delay, it wasn't eating into my challenge. So I always set for 110 days. What I didn't take into account, how good the roads were, the conditions, and that's what caught me out as well. And so we had great conditions. I had a lovely tailwind all the way through Peru. I had really strong winds down in Argentina. Yeah, really bad. So yeah, I took 10 days off the South America world record, which was great boost then moving forward. And obviously, as I'm going along, I'm now getting physically and mentally fitter. Mm. I'd never cycled more than 150 miles. There, anything less at this point just wasn't enough. I was getting, I was getting mentally stronger. And I got to North America on day 70, and I thought, perfect. I'm now 14 days ahead of the world record. So should I need a couple of days rest, I can have it here. My wife then called me and said, we've been kindly invited to the royal wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. And I was like, great. Great to be invited, but it then changed the dynamics completely of the challenge. My wife said, you need to be, your latest flight out from Prudhoe Bay, which is the finish point in Alaska, is day 102, which is 15 days ahead of the world record. So the following day, I was in Texas in Lubbock, and we had 60-mile-an-hour winds and tornadoes, and I got stuck. I got stuck there. And there was an app on my phone called Windy TV, and I was looking at this, and I then, to miss the next weather front, I had to cycle 320 miles in the next 36 hours to miss that weather window. And that's all I did for North America. I was playing chess with Mother Nature with the winds. Mm. I was cycling through the nights, trying to find tailwinds. I got to Cheyenne. Got a lovely tailwind, did 260 miles in 11 hours, 10,000 feet of climbing, yeah. But the luxury I had in North America and Canada, we didn't have in South and Central, which is a security issue. So down in South and Central, I was quite fine with the security, but obviously you have a documentary team and a support team, you need to think of their welfare. So we would only cycle in daylight hours. I didn't have that restriction in North America and Canada, so I could cycle through the evening. So on paper, I had 17 days planned for North America. I cycled it in 11 and a half days. Mm. And I got to Canada, and I was a week outside from the end, and I thought, right, the world record's in the bag, not an issue. I'm going to be back in time for this royal wedding. And I then got a phone call from a friend who made me aware of a German cyclist, a professional cyclist, who wanted to be the first person to cycle Pan America Highway in under 100 days. So again, now the dynamics have changed completely. So I cycled for 22 hours in the last 30 hours in minus 18 in Alaska to come in under 100 days.
So 99 days, 12 hours, 56 minutes. What's next?
What's next? So I've enjoyed cycling. I've dipped my toe in and I dip it out. I like to be the underdog. You know, I talked about, you know, your last 2 minutes and you know, you can't do it. So I'm going to take the same sort of template from this. I'm going to take a discipline I've never done before and find the biggest challenge. So the next challenge is to kayak the River Nile solo from source to sea. It's never been done before from source to sea. And I set off in June. So I'm now in the research and planning phase and I'll start reaching out for sponsorship soon as well.
But when do you go?
I go off in January.
Oh, January, right.
I set off in January on this one. But there's so many great opportunities with this one. You know, the last campaign was for mental health. This campaign is for human trafficking and modern slavery. Mm. I won't set a target of £1 million. That was probably harder than the challenge itself. But we will raise awareness. We will have a giving page. But we're also going to take advantage of this situation. You know, we're going to meet with the Royal Geographical Society, maybe do some science and research along the way, because there's a lot of other issues along the Nile as well. You know, the Nile's, you know, with climate change as well, you know, it's shrinking. You know, you've got a dam in Ethiopia, the largest dam in Africa, it's getting built, which is on the Blue Nile, which is obviously going to stop a lot of the water going to Egypt. So there's going to be a lot of displacement as well. So there's going to be a lot of issues in the future regards the Nile, and I'll probably highlight this on the campaign as well.
Mate, I could speak all day, but we can't. Thanks so much for coming in.
No pleasure.
And we will leave it there.